The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
You're never really a guest at Israelite, right? It takes about one class or one good baked challah to become mishpacha, you know? In our last discussion concerning the progression of ethics from the time of Noah into the time of Abraham, and more specifically the ethical model of Abraham, we glossed over a very important detail. And I want to share with you a perception on that particular detail. And I want you, as usual, to bear in mind that in no way can you consider the class you're about to hear as a full treatment of the topic. That would be absurd. Nor can it even be an answer to some of the issues that I'm going to raise, but at the very least, a perspective. Why do we pray? And what is prayer supposed to be? My father always used to tell me, my father is a teacher with some probably 30 years experience. He used to say, you know, teachers think that you should try very hard never to repeat the same topic twice. It's okay to repeat the same topic 10 times, as long as you know you're repeating it 10 times. It seems to me that there are some major issues with regards to tefillah, to prayer. Now, prayer is one of the major, most fundamental fulcrums on which Judaism rests. As a matter of fact, the Mishnah in Ethics of the Fathers tells me that the world, not just Judaism, the world stands on three pillars. Al shlosha dvarim ha'olam omed. One of the first things I read in Ethics of the Fathers, in one of the most central sets of Mishnayot in the entire Mishnaic system, the Mishnah is the first time that the oral tradition was written down, and it is a representation of the entire oral tradition within Judaism. And it's interesting that this appears not in some work of philosophy, but in a work at least that's entitled, right, Ethics of the Fathers. And it's interesting that the Talmud tells me that if I want to learn how to be a Hasid, right, and a Hasid doesn't mean like, you know, a Lubavitcher Hasid, that came much, much later. But a Hasid in the time of the Talmud, in the period of, let's say, up until 500 CE, meant an incredibly righteous individual. How could you do that? Milei da'avot, to learn the words of the fathers, to learn our heritage. And according to some commentators, they're specifically speaking about Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers. And so in Ethics of the Fathers, right at the beginning of Ethics of the Fathers, in fact, really the second teaching in Ethics of the Fathers, Rabbi Shimon HaTzadik, and he was called a tzaddik also. Only three individuals that are known in Judaism to be called a tzaddik. One we studied the other day, Noah. The other, who was called a tzaddik, but never mentioned actually in the written, in the Bible. And yet the rabbis call him a tzaddik, is Yosef. And the third, from the period of the oral tradition, is Shimon HaTzadik. And Shimon HaTzadik was one of the leftovers of the men of the Great Assembly. He was a carryover into the period of the Mishnah, which was the Second Temple period. He was a carryover from the days of the prophets. He even rubbed shoulders with some of the prophets who prophesied at the end of the First Temple. So what he has to say is not to be taken lightly. He knew Mordechai of Purim fame. He knew Daniel of the lion's den. This is not just another rabbi. And he says that the world stands on three things. And it's interesting that this is within the context of Ethics of the Fathers, which is supposed to somehow make me a better person. So I'm all excited, because I'm going to discover now what the world is about. And I'm looking to discover, who am I? Right? I didn't know I was looking to discover who am I, but then I went to Rabbi Aaron's lecture last night, and now I know, I'm looking to discover, who am I? Who am I? So I figure I'll open up Ethics of the Fathers. I can develop a sense of ethic, I can find out what the world is about, and sure enough, second Mishnah comes along, Shimon HaTzadik, three things that the world is all about. Al shlosha dvarim ha'olam omed, stands on three things, ala Torah, on Torah, Al ha'avodah, and we'll call it worship for the moment, the al gemilut chasadim, and on acts of loving kindness. Now, that's not a simple combination. Because what are those three things? Now, we could spend a lifetime figuring out what Torah is. But let's say the Torah is what we've been discussing. So what is Torah? A book of what? Laws. Ethics. A book of mitzvot. But we said at least that one way of looking at what mitzvot are about, commandments are about, is that they're supposed to make me a better person. And that the world is supposed to become a better place. And that somehow Torah has something to offer to the world, which is what makes it worthwhile. And that's that we're aspiring to become better. But rather than trying to teach everybody else how to become better, the challenge is, can I become better? If I become better, then the world becomes better. Okay, so that's Torah. What's the last one? Well, the last one's easy. Gmilut chasadim. Acts of loving kindness. So what's acts of loving kindness? Ethics. How to treat your fellow human being. Now, why acts of loving kindness are separate from Torah, according to my original definition, is a difficult question. But put that aside for the moment. Right? Hello! Right? Put that aside for the moment. But what about the middle one? By the way, interesting question, which you will find is very important in the treatment of this topic in general. Does anybody notice anything linguistically incorrect about this sentence, if you know a little Hebrew? Torah, avodah, and gemilut chasadim? Pardon? Avodah is work, but it's a higher definition of work. What am I really working for? In English, they translate it. It's very hard to translate it. But in English, they translate it as service. What's an eved? An eved is a slave. We are all ultimately enslaved. The challenge is, to what are we enslaved? Do we choose to be enslaved to ourselves, to our desires, or to be enslaved to some higher ideal? But we're all something. Rules how we behave. So avodah is generally meant to mean some sort of service of God, and it usually refers to prayer. Torah, prayer, the service of the heart, and acts of loving kindness. But what's wrong with this, linguistically?
First two words, right?
It shouldn't be avodah, it should be avodot. Or it should be gemilut chesed, acts of loving kindness in the singular. So what's chesedim? Tremendous idea, bunim. Irving Bunim writes a magnificent, there's a copy of it, there's a three-volume set that's in green. Sometimes I think people make their books ridiculous colors so that you'll notice them on the shelf. It's working to his benefit right now. It is one of, if not the best, treatments of Pirkei Avot of Ethics of the Fathers that I know of. Magnificent set. And you can take a look at it afterwards, you should. And he suggests, he actually quotes Shakespeare. Shakespeare in A Merchant of Venice, right, in her soliloquy, in Portia's soliloquy, mercy is a quality twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives and him that takes. When you do acts of loving kindness, you get as much as you give. And this is great. Because what he's really saying, if I'm to look at the first and the third, is that the whole world is really based on kindness. Except what's the middle one? What's tefillah? What's prayer? How does prayer work? How does prayer fit in this theme? In fact, when you really think about it, let's be honest, to a certain degree, prayer is selfish. To a certain degree. I mean, it's true that I can be praying for someone else. But of necessity, when I pray, I sort of lock myself away from what's around me. I say, please don't disturb me. The halakha tells me that if I'm praying and someone comes over and says hello, right? Someone drops a bag of groceries in front of me if I'm praying, at least the Shemona Esrei, right? The silent meditation, prayer, then I don't stop what I'm doing. You don't interrupt your conversation with God to help somebody with their vegetables, which is very difficult to understand. I thought, actually, that's exactly what God would want you to do. I mean, I would never have a problem if somebody interrupted a conversation with me to help somebody else. I would be quite complimented. So, what is prayer? And it seems to me that there are certain issues with regards to prayer that prevent us somehow from being able to achieve what we can achieve in prayer. And I will warn you by telling you that there are different stages in prayer, and that I'm going to share with you the first stage, what I believe is the first stage. And I also want you to know that much of what I'm going to say, if not directly, at least indirectly, partially from conversations with him, and partially from his book, Generation to Generation, is based on some of the thoughts that I heard from Rav Tversky. Rav Avraham Tversky wrote a book, he wrote a number of books, IMI, Generation to Generation. Brilliant individual, I think I mentioned him the other day. If you're curious about him, come and ask me. He lives in a frat down the road. He'll be here by Pesach. I'll tell you a quick story, because it always comes to mind. Maybe it's just because I can't think of a better way to express my problem when it comes to prayer. But this particular story, you know, every now and then things happen to you which have a profound influence on who you are, on your thinking. Like you just say, I have to rethink everything. I'll give you an example. This is now the summer. Now you'll remember. People never remember the class, but the story they always remember. It was the summer of 1984, 85. And we were in Lebanon. I'd been with this unit for about, 3 months already. And we were doing a Petichat Tzir and a Tavas. A Petichat Tzir is a very specific type of patrol. At that time, so Lebanon was a hot zone. And there was no Israeli army vehicular traffic that was allowed at night. So in the morning, they used to send out Israeli army patrols to sort of clear the road, to make sure that there were no funny-looking booby traps and wires and all sorts of other things, you know, just in general to make sure that they were safe. So you would go out, you know, as a 12-man patrol, and you would patrol this particular stretch and make sure that it was safe. And the other thing that you were doing was that it was a tavas. Now, a tavas was a much more skilled issue, because what you were doing was making sure you were sort of scanning the border and making sure that during the night, when, you know, no one had been out there to get a good look at it, that no terrorists had sneaked over the border, headed for Israel, etc. Now, we were in Lebanon, but obviously the area that was Israeli controlled, so there was a barbed wire area and there was whatever, a border between the area that we weren't really in. And we're walking along, it was like, I don't know, 4:45 in the morning. Thank God it was in the summer. And the Israeli army learned from various experiences, and I think this is a general military tradition, to do something called Konanuti Mshacha, which means that the best time for an enemy to attack is traditionally just before dawn, because that's when people are tired, and that's when they don't expect it, and they're in a deeper sleep. And so the Israeli army, many of the units that are in frontline positions, wake up half an hour before this supposed period, and they go on automatic alert. It's the most depressing thing. They wake you up out of the most incredible sleep. You don't actually have guard duty in the morning, but they wake you up. Everybody has to get up, hit their positions, defend their base for like 45 minutes till the, you know, the dawn comes and it's light, and then they go back to sleep, right? And you do this every day for months on end, just in case some Syrian will decide that this is a good time to attack, right? In any event, until they discover the virtual reality, you know, alert system. But anyway, so you finish that, and then the patrol that has to go out, you go out on patrol. So when your patrol actually is 4:45, it's not so bad because you're up anyway. And Lebanon is just, it's a magnificent country. It's beautiful. I mean, the Shuf Mountains rise up behind you. They're snow-capped even in the summer. And the Mediterranean Sea is before you. And the cherry orchards are blooming late spring, summer. And it's just magnificent. And it makes it all the more tragic that they've been at war for so long. And you're walking along. And everybody has their pakal, their particular piece of equipment that they carry. So one guy carries a stretcher, one guy carries a, you know, heavy machine gun, and there's an order of walking, and, you know, you're walking in day distances, right? The officer, so I was the officer, so the officer's always in front, and right behind him is always the radio man in case he has to call for help or whatever it might be, and the machine gun is always in the middle, and there's a stretcher man always in the back, and the jerry can, and you sort of learn this, you know where everybody is instinctively when you need the rocket-propelled grenade, so you know where to look for him because that's his spot, and he carries his thing. It's a very strange type of a morning constitutional, you know, walk, because on the one hand it's beautiful and you're sort of admiring the beauty and the birds are starting to sing, you know, and the sun hasn't yet risen, it's beautiful. On the other hand, you're sort of computing as you walk. In other words, as an officer, you're walking along, you've got 12 men in your command and you're responsible, God forbid, you don't look at, a tree isn't a tree, a tree is cover. So you're thinking, okay, what would I do if I was attacked here? Well, if I was attacked from over there, then I'd use this ditch as a rollout cover, and I'd set up my pincer movement over there, and I'd probably set up my cover fire from the machine gun nest over there, and I'd lay smoke over here. And that's what you do. And you're thinking this about if I'm attacked from the front, and if I'm attacked from behind, and if I'm attacked from the sides, then you walk another 30, 40 meters, and you can't use that ditch anymore, because it's too far back, and I'm going to turn around and run back to the ditch. So you got to recompute this. And that's how you're walking. right? That's why they give to men who are up, you know, in those situations, they give them like a week off every 2-3 weeks because it's just, the pressure is just intense. And so on the one hand, it's gorgeous. And, you know, you don't really think it's going to happen to you. On the other hand, you know, sort of in the pit of your stomach, you know it could happen to you, and so there's this pressure. And everybody has their particular item, you know, machine gun, stretcher, mortar grenades, M203 grenade launcher, jerry can, radio, fine. Now, the most important individual on this patrol, and in any patrol, by the way, in Lebanon, is what's called a gashash. A gashash is an Israeli army tracker. And usually they use Bedouin and Druze trackers, not Jews. And these men are incredible. And this particular guy, who was already, you know, an adult relative to some of the other trackers, his name was Magbul. And they learned to track, you know, most of them are shepherds. And so, you know, when they're very young, I mean, a sheep is worth a lot of money in that economy. And if a sheep gets lost in the desert, they have to go find him and bring him back. They learn how to track. This particular guy, Magbul, was absolutely incredible. I mean, the things he could see was amazing. I mean, there was a legend about him in the battalion, before I got to the battalion. But it'll just tell you who you're dealing with. You'll understand the story because they wouldn't tell legends like this about me. And there was a legend, they were doing a mirdaf. And a mirdaf is like a chase, like they find terrorists. And they decide that they have to catch them, you know. And they spot their tracks. And what they do is they box them in. Like they have a path that they see that their tracks are on, and they have another one they see it's not there. They know they're in between, and they gradually box them in. So he was running a mirdaf. Like, they spotted two terrorists, and they called in all sorts of troops, but since he was the tracker that first spotted it, he was responsible for it. And they chased them up into the Shuf Mountains, and the sun was setting, and the battalion commander decided to call off the chase. They'd effectively fulfilled their mission, prevented two terrorists from entering Israel. That's what the security zone, which was bigger than, was for. Fine. He was very upset. He had never lost a quarry. And he argued with the battalion commander, which you just don't do. But he was a tracker, so he'd get away with this sort of thing. And the battalion commander held his ground. He wasn't taking troops up into the Shuf Mountains at night. It was too dangerous, right? Maybe he saw Rambo, right? So, fine. The next day, Magbul disappeared. Disappeared without a gun, without a map, without anything but his knife. Didn't know where he was. He didn't show up for his patrol. He was gone for 2 days. He came back 2 days later. He walked into the battalion commander's office with a little pouch, threw it on the guy's desk and walked out. Inside were 2 ears. He had gone up alone into the Shuf Mountains with a knife. He had found these terrorists, killed them, and he later led the Israeli army up into the mountains to this whole arms cache and underground war in the tunnels. So this is who you're talking about, right? I mean, this is like, you know, very tough guy. And he was, and the things that he could see, we were walking along this path, which was about as wide as this room, and it was swept clean twice a day by the Israeli army. And the idea was it was, you know, sanded down. The idea was that, you know, you'd be able to spot tracks. So, you know, obviously he could, you know, I could spot a track. But he could tell you who made the track. Was it made by a Jew or an Arab based on, like, the shoe prints and things like that? He could tell you how much weight the guy was carrying. He could tell you if the weight was live weight or dead weight. In other words, is the guy carrying equipment? Or, as once happened to us, was he actually carrying another guy on his back? Which would mean that you'd be looking for one guy. I never figured that one out. Something to do with like the grade of the heel prints or whatever. He could tell you if it was an animal, what animal it was, whether the animal had eaten already that day. I mean, just unbelievable things, you know? And I learned early on, I mean, you know, unless he was pulling my leg, but I learned early on not to ask him questions. Like when I was like a new officer in the unit, so I said, oh, wow, what's that? You know, duh, right? So, you know, he was like the real strong, silent type, and he had this glare that would just cut you up, slice you into bits, put you in the garbage, and finish with you, right? Something to the effect of like, right? So I learned not to ask stupid questions. And gradually, like, I learned to work with him. And I didn't ask questions as I was there. And I learned a lot from watching him. And sometimes he would share things with me. Okay. Anyway, we're walking along on this patrol on this particular day. And, you know, like I said, I mean, we developed a healthy sense of how to work with each other. And I'd been with these guys for 3 months. So there was like a routine. Every time he would stop, right, to look at something. More often than not, he would look at, like, animal tracks. Or he would say, you know, like, some guy in the reserves stopped here to take a piss or whatever it might be. But every time he would stop. So the unit would stop too, and everybody would go down on one knee. You know, the guys in the back are sort of facing back to cover the back, and the guys in the front are facing front to cover front, and the sides are facing out. And, you know, he would look whatever he was looking, and then he would keep walking, we'd all get up and walk with him. So this day was no different than any other, and we're doing this Ptichat Tzir, and we're also looking for booby traps, and it's Lebanon, and it's beautiful, but you're nervous, and you're computing. And Magbul stops to take a look at something, right? And okay, you know, everybody goes down on one knee, and I'm glancing over, and as usual, you know, I have no idea what he's looking at, because it's all sand to me, right? And then, you know, he keeps walking. And then he does something that I never saw him do before, or since. He turns around, and he walks back to what he'd seen. Now, my bull just didn't do this. Because he was just like, he just didn't do this. So this made me a little nervous. But on the other hand, I'm looking around. We're in this wide open area. There's maybe like a low rise off in the distance. So if I was like in the middle of a forest, I'd be nervous. Did he see something and somebody, you know, but there was nothing there. So he's looking at this, right? And I'm like sort of thinking like maybe he saw an interesting animal. So I kind of walk over. Maybe I'll pick up a tidbit, but not dumb enough to say, what do you see, right? And get one of those glares. And then he just keeps walking and everybody keeps walking, right? And then he does it again. And he walks back. And then he starts pacing back and forth. Now this is a problem. Because at this point, right, so the whole unit has moved, but now he's back. So, the, you know, nobody's supposed to walk in front of the tracker, right? So, you know, the M203 guy who was behind him is now moving back with him, and the guys are getting a little bunched up. And whenever you break routine in a situation like that, it makes you nervous. It certainly made me nervous. So I said, "Mind Yanim, you know, what's going on?" He goes, "Shh." So like 11 safeties click off automatically. Like, what's going on, you know? But on the other hand, we're in this wide open area, and I don't see anything. And this whole thing, like I'm describing to you this, but this whole thing is like 20 seconds. I mean, you know, we're not talking like a long, you know, a minute. And then he walks again, and this time he walks quickly, right? So that we can't keep up with him. And he's doing this for like 2 minutes that seemed to me like an eternity. And I'm looking around, and I'm debating, should I tell the guys to like spread, or should we stay in line, whatever? And he stands up straight, and he looks around. He looks off at this low rise, and all of a sudden he says, "Kulama Yisba! Everybody hit the dirt!" Now, if I told you in this room, everybody hit the dirt, you'd look at me like I was a Looney Tune. But if you're in Lebanon, and a Bedouin tracker, or Druze tracker, tells you to hit the dirt, then that's what you do. So everybody hit the dirt. And you hit the dirt where you stand, and you do a Gilgul Krav, you roll out, you know, because you don't want to be just where you dropped, and you roll out, and the heavy machine gun is already, you know, clipping up his ammo, and the guy with the extra ammo is crawling over to him, the M203 guy is pulling out the grenade launcher and pumping it in, right? And the RPG anti-rocket launcher is crawling up forward, and the radio man is crawling over to me, and he's already called in battalion, because this is all routine, right? And I'm looking around, and I don't see anything. We're out in the middle of this open area, we're all hitting the dirt and rolling around, and there's nothing going on. And I'm screaming like, you know, "Khadal, khadal, nobody should fire, because I don't want anybody to hit anybody, and I don't know what's going on." And I'm thinking to myself, if this is a joke, I'm going to kill him when we get back to base, right? Like I figured maybe because I asked Mayan Yanim, you know, I had the gall and audacity to say what was going on, so he figured he'd pay me a lesson, right? I'm only thinking, like when we get back to base, I'm going to kill him, and they opened up. There were three of them. There were three terrorists. They were hiding behind this low rise. They were waiting for us to get into their field of fire. And at this point, everything becomes chaos, right? So the machine gunner automatically opens up machine gun fire, and I have to redirect his fire. And at the same time, we have to set up a pincer movement and move around, and we're laying down. So the M203 guy's laying down smoke, and the stretcher guy's in the back setting up a stretcher, and the battalion commander wants to get in touch with me, but I don't have time. And there's a general rule in the Israeli army, you don't just get into a firefight, but you do what's called Kadima Yisteir, and you get up and you charge the position, and the cover fire keeps their head low, and you have to set up a pincer movement so that you come around from the side so that they can cover them. So that's what we're doing. So I'm going around the side behind the smoke, and they're laying down machine gun fire, but of course we're in open areas, not much of a pincer movement you can do, and we're running up this hill, and thank God, Baruch Hashem, you know, we got up to the hill, two of them were killed on the spot, the third ended up dying in a helicopter on the way to Rambam Hospital. But at this point, I have to give a report to battalion command. I have to make sure that all my men are okay. We have to check the terrorists because, you know, we have to make sure that there's no booby traps. We have to secure the area. We can't forget our original patrol line. At this point, the battalion commander finally gets in touch. He wants a complete report. 5 minutes later, after I'm securing the area, we have to decide what to do about our original patrol. So we get a call from the division commander. The division commander wants a full report. Then the battalion commander shows up. He wants to see exactly what happened. We have to secure the area. There's a helicopter that's sent out. They're sent around. We have to make sure that there are no other terrorists that got away. We have to figure out how this all worked out. We have to call in reserve duty soldiers to cover our original patrol line. There was a TV news crew. To this day, I don't know how they got this. Maybe they were monitoring radio that showed up about a half an hour later. And they wanted to be in. They wanted to interview me to figure out what happened because they had a boring day. And you have to get the division commanders okay to do that. But you can't go to the division commander. Let's go to the battalion commander. The battalion commander was busy. And I'm trying to figure all these things out. Meanwhile, we're making sure that there's no booby traps. We're making sure that all the guys are okay. And one guy got hit in the leg, so he had to be taken care of. And the medic was taking care of him. And I was talking to him. And we had to evacuate him. And we were debating, should we evacuate him with three terrorists in the same helicopter? Is that a good idea? Is it too many people? Who should go first? The terrorist who's dying, the Israeli soldier who's wounded in the leg, and all of these different issues. And finally, about 3 hours later, everything finally calms down. And I see Magbul, this, you know, tracker, sitting on a jeep. He's got his feet up, cigarette in one hand, cup of coffee in the other. Now, what do you do? I mean, what do you say to a guy like that? I mean, this is a guy that just saved your life. No doubt about it. It turned out that they had walked across the border on these huge styrofoam pieces that they had cut out and carved away so that it displaced their weight in case they were mines, and so that you couldn't see anything. You couldn't see any footprints. And he had somehow, I never quite figured this out, but the battalion commander told me this because he had to report to the battalion commander, right? That somehow it displaced their weight, and also he had seen somehow some dirt that had been moved, and he knew it wasn't natural, and he knew it was fresh, and he couldn't figure out what it was. And he figured that if there was anybody there, it had to be very recent. Maybe they were granules moving, I don't know. And he looked around, and he saw that was the only place that they could hide. So he told us to hit the dirt. Because he figured if there was anybody there, they'd be there. So what do you say? Thank you? I mean, have you ever heard a more inadequate word to thank somebody for saving your life? And never mind my life. I mean, he saved the life of, including himself, 11 of my men. I want you to know one of the most difficult things to do as an officer is to have to go to a parent and explain to them how their son was killed in your command. And it doesn't matter if it wasn't your fault, if it was your fault. He saved that for me 11 times. No doubt about it. We were about, I'd say, 20 seconds away from walking into their kill zone. And they were just watching us and waiting for us to get close enough. So what do you say? And I stood there like an idiot. And, you know, you can guess already. I'm not the kind of guy who's usually at a loss for words. I had no idea what to say. Partially because it was him and part... I stood there for like 10 minutes, and finally he noticed me, you know, or maybe it was a minute, maybe it was 20, I don't know. He gives me a big slap on the back, right? No words. Goes back to his cigarette. Like, that was the longest conversation, you know, I ever had with him. Sometimes, there are things that you can't express. Sometimes there are ideas that you can't put into words. It's kind of like a niggun. The difference between a song with words, which has tremendous power, to be singing words is an unbelievable thing. And a nigun, which comes from the word linagen, to play. Shlomo Kalbach loved nigunim. And the power of a nigun is that it has no words. It comes straight out of what's inside of it. Somehow, there is some of that in tefillah. There is some of that in prayer. There's an idea when we pray that there's something deep inside of us that's indescribable, that can't really be put into words. And that really creates a tremendous problem. Because if that's true, when you think about it, if there's a part of me inside that should be allowed to free fall, that should be flexible, fluid, that should relate to who I am and my personal relationship with God, and that's what prayer should be, and I shouldn't even try to express it in words, and we sense this all the time in our words, because we give words to things that we know we can't really name. All the time. There's a beautiful tradition in the Talmud. 30 days after a child is conceived, some say 30 days before, that a heavenly voice comes out and announces certain things about this child. That's the Talmud tells me. Who that child's going to marry, who the child is going to be, what the child's name will be. Now, this is a section of Talmud known as Agadah, right? It's not halakha. It's not a literal rendering. It's allegorical. It's supposed to teach me something. What does that mean? But when we had our first child, our daughter, and each child subsequently, three children, Baruch Hashem, so we put a lot of thought into what their name is. Because at least Kabbalistically, a name is very much a part of who you are. And the opportunity to name a child is to be a partner somehow in deciding and determining and shaping who that person can be. So you can play the game of predeterminism and choice, chicken and egg, backwards and forwards. And if it was preordained, then we didn't really name. It was just that vision that God gave me, and I'm the vessel, and whatever else Rabbi Aaron spoke about, that's fine. But my daughter is, in fact, a Mayan. Mayan means an overflowing wellspring, a brook, and that's exactly what she is. You'll meet her, B'ezrat Hashem, next Shabbat. So sometimes a word, but I don't think that I can name. I can't, in one word, express who my child is. When I say thank you, do I really think I've adequately expressed an idea in a word? That's absurd. Thank you is such a deep, deep idea. And it stems from such an inner part of who we are. I can't possibly imagine that if you do something for me simply because you're a good human being, and because you care about me, simply because I'm a human being, or for whatever the thought process is, that my response to that can be just a word. It runs much deeper than that. Our biggest challenge is that because we want to be able to communicate, we use words to remember that they are, after all, only words. I mean, what was that before we gave it a word? It was the deep concept. Rabbi Aaron once gave a lecture, and he was talking about his son, I think. But the story I remember. And he was saying that they were walking, and his son was a little kid, 3 years old. I don't remember which son, Baruch Hashem. And they saw a bird. And the son said, "What's that?" And he said, "It's a bird." He says, "Oh." And he's looking at this bird, and he sees another bird. So he says to his father, "Well, what's that?" Right? He says, "Well, that's a bird." So the kid is like, "Well, if that's a bird, how can that be a bird?" So we think to ourselves, right, "Oh, silly child, they're both birds." But of course the child is right. They're not both birds, they're not exactly the same. They're two completely separate ideas. Two totally separate creations. Two totally separate levels of magnificent manifestation of God. And we trivialize them by giving them a name, by calling them just bird. And this child, who's 3 years old, he has the ability to see the bird before it's a bird. It's a tremendous idea. You know, one of the things I love about this place is that I get challenged not just by my students, but by the people I'm privileged to work with. And whenever I sit in Rabbi Cardozo or Rabbi Aaron's lectures, I walk away and I need to walk. You know, I just need to think. And I remember processing these thoughts. And he wasn't talking about tefillah. He was talking about something completely different. But for me, it's very much related to tefillah. How do I deign to express the ideas, the magnificence that is prayer in a word? Okay. That is really part of a much larger series of questions, which I think prevent us somehow from being able to develop a relationship through prayer with God, and really with prayer. And I'll give you a few examples. First of all, who am I praying to? And if I'm praying to whatever God is, why do I really have to pray? I mean, the traditional system of prayer, which is what I'm analyzing. In other words, I want you to understand that you can go up on this rooftop, sit in the lotus, and be in the deepest prayer without ever opening a prayer book. Like, don't make the mistake of assuming that prayer is limited to a book. And yet, when I look at traditional Judaism, that's what everybody does. We all get stuck in this script, which is prayer. How does that work? Why do I need to do that? And I'll give you the best example I can think of. Take, for example, the prayer known as Rifa'enu. We ask God to heal us. This is one of the prayers that we say as a part of the Shemona Esrei, as a part of the 18 benedictions that we say as the center point, it's the focus of prayer. Right? So what am I asking? Right? Rifa'enu. Heal us. Anybody, by the way, ever say this prayer? Has anyone here ever said this prayer? Yeah, when was the last time you said this prayer? Oh, okay. Fine. A week ago. Rifa'enu. Have you been sick in the last week? Chutzpah! It's a chutzpah. Don't you think it's a chutzpah? It's rude. I get up before God. I'm healthy. And I say, "God, heal us." So you almost expect God to be sitting up there and saying, "Wait a second. Hang on a second. Hey, Gabriel, come here. Yeah, we got one from Langfelder. Did we make her sick this week? I don't think so. You know what? Send her some plague. She needs a little lesson." God, what does that mean? So give me an obvious answer. Why am I asking God to heal us? Pardon? Okay, okay, I'll buy that. Ooh, I like that. Don't take anything I say now personally, but spiritual healing. Except for one little problem. See, that's a great idea. And when I first struggled with this, I thought, that's it. We're not asking God just to heal me physically. What a waste of time. What do I care if my arm is falling off?
I want to be spiritually healed.
Except there's one little problem. Because there's this little section in the prayer book at the bottom of the prayer that says, it's a magnificent idea, that if you know somebody, or you yourself, who's really sick, you can put in as a part of this prayer their name. You can say, Virapei etachule, and heal the sick person, you know, Ploni ben Almoni, whatever, Joe, the son of George, I don't know, whatever, right? And you can actually ask for them to be healed. Now, it's not saying that if you know someone who's just spiritually sick, if there's some real cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, depressed person, whatever you want to say, no, it's saying, God forbid, somebody's in the hospital, he wants to be better. Okay, here's your opportunity, pray. So it's not only spiritual, it's physical. Now, you could, I will grant you, argue with me. Get ready, because this is deep. Ready? You could argue with me that, really, all physical sickness is spiritual sickness. And all spiritual sickness manifests itself into physical sickness. But we're not going to talk about that. Because I have a different perception. This is a very difficult prayer. In fact, I'll go you a stage further. Like, you know, so you mentioned, Jonathan, you mentioned, well, us. What do you mean by that? Good, Jeff, go ahead there. What do you mean, like, Rifa'enu, heal us? Why would I be asking to heal us? We're not all sick. So maybe there are people who are sick, and therefore, perhaps, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying, not heal me, but heal everybody. And this is a great idea. I mean, you know, I'm in prayer, and I'm thinking of, like, people in Ethiopia, and Rwanda, Syrian Jews, Afghanistan, the world, peace, love, understanding. Wonderful. Even assuming for the moment that that's what I'm really feeling, halavai, you know, would that it would be that we could get to that level sort of, you know, when we think this thought. But I'll ask you a simpler prayer. What if there's someone you know who's really not well? I don't know, God forbid, your mother is sick. Now me, I have a good relationship with my mother. She doesn't have to wake me up for school anymore. So Baruch Hashem, I have a good relationship with my mother. So it went uphill from there. So God forbid, if she would be sick, you know, shouldn't happen. So I would want to pray that she would be better. Okay, in fact, I'll give you a better example. Because I remember, this is like now, what, 4 or 5 years ago almost. My daughter, Mayan, my eldest, she got really sick. She had like 106 fever. We couldn't get anything down her. She was dehydrating as we watched. So we took her to the emergency room. We called up a doctor. We said, get her to the emergency room. Something's wrong. So we took her to the emergency room. Didn't know what it was. Some brilliant intern told my wife not to worry because if it was a kidney infection and they had to remove a kidney, children could live very well with one kidney, which of course calmed my wife down, right? Yeah. We sent death squads after that guy. And it turned out that it was a virus. But they didn't know exactly what it was, so they kept her in the hospital for like 5 days. Now she had a wonderful time. Because some rich person who had promised she was going straight to heaven donated this game room in Shaare Tzedek Hospital for children. It's unbelievable. So she spent the whole week, and except for the blood tests and whatever else that she couldn't stand, she was 2 years old, she spent the whole week finger painting and electric organs and storybooks and playhouses, and life was grand, right? For me, you could understand, and for us, it was very difficult. I mean, to see your little child, 2-year-old child, with an IV and blood tests and bring them in the hospital, and you don't know what's wrong with them, and you hope it's going to be okay, you can imagine, it's not, it's scary. So you can imagine that week, for me, that prayer became very significant. I have to tell God that I want him to heal my daughter? He doesn't know? I have to tell him? I mean, the thought process is absurd. And you know what? Who made her sick to begin with? God! So what a chutzpah on my part to tell God to change his mind. Listen, God, I know you made her sick, but I think maybe you made a mistake. Not a 2-year-old. That's ridiculous. What I should say, God, you know what? Shouldn't happen. If my mother's sick, she probably deserves it. Give us some more. There must be a reason. That's what I should say. I'm happy you made me sick. I'm sure there's a reason in my faith. Magnificent. Wonderful. That's not what tefillah is about. I'm supposed to be praying for everybody else to get better. So God's wrong. Or God's right. I don't know. And you should know that this is a fundamental question of prayer. And it exists really for every part of prayer. I mean, I remember when I ran into my old unit in a place called Aleh.
which is a little suburb of Beirut. And I hadn't been with a minyan, for like with a quorum, with a regular prayer service, for like almost 4 months. Because I left, I was in a Hesder yeshiva, which is a yeshiva, some of you may know, I do know, that there's a big debate today in Israeli society. Go to the army, go to yeshiva, study Torah, defend the country. And there's a group of yeshivot that believe that both are an ideal. And that a person can sit and study Torah and value his Jewish heritage, and yet that a part of the study of that Torah should be defense of the country and everything else, and that's a mitzvah too. I happen to agree with that. These yeshivot are called hesder, which means an arrangement. I don't think that it's a compromise. I think it's the ideal, actually. It's my personal opinion, but whatever. And it's a magnificent system. And that's how I went into the army. So for the first 6 months, I was with a lot of other, whatever it means, religious guys. And every morning we had prayers. And then I left to go to sergeants and later to officers' courses. And so I was pretty much the only religious guy in my unit. So I ran into these guys, my old unit, about, I don't know, 5 kilometers outside of Beirut, overlooking Beirut. And you can imagine for me, it was very special to be with them. It happened to be Rosh Chodesh, the new month. And so they had a minyan, and I went and joined them. I walked like a kilometer from my tanks to go be with them. And it was a very powerful tefillah. When you looked around, that day I actually found out that a couple guys who had been in our unit had been killed. I didn't know it. And it was a very powerful prayer. I remember there was a new song as a part of the Hallel, the thanksgiving to God. Ma ashiv l'Hashem. What do I give back to God? Kol tagmulohi alai. Like all of my payback is on me. You know, how do you respond? Nidaraya shalem, I'll pay back. You know, in battle you make a lot of vows. Oh God, if I make it, I promise. You gotta pay up? And there's a beautiful tune to this. And these guys started singing it. And I want to tell you, 50 guys on a hilltop, very powerful. Now I remember in the service, when the chazan, the person leading the service, got to the prayer for peace. Sing shalom. Give us peace. It wasn't a dry eye in the place. I have to tell God I want peace? Nobody appreciates the value of peace like somebody who's seen war. I have to tell God I want peace? And beyond that, who made the war? God made the war. So he must know what he's doing. So what a chutzpah for me to tell God I want peace. I should get up every morning. Oh God, whatever's going to happen today, good for you. I'm sure you know what you're doing. Have a nice day and I'll talk to you again this afternoon. It'd be very easy. Everybody would pray. So what's going on here? How does prayer work? Who am I praying to? What am I praying for? Why do I have to say it? Why can't I just think it? What's the audacity that I have to make these requests of God, this almost shopping list mentality that we have? In order to respond to these questions, and I remind you not to answer, but at least to respond, so I have to ask you another question. This is a very difficult story. It's a story that appears in Exodus chapter 32, and it is really one of the fulcrum events in Judaism. God says to Moshe, Lech raid. Okay? Go, Lech raid. Ki shichet amcha, because your people have become destructive. Go down the mountain, because your people have become destructive. So what event are we talking about? Sin of the golden calf, right? The Meshech Chachmah of Meir Simcha Vint has a powerful idea. He says, I mean, this is the first time anyone says to anybody else in the Bible, get down. But what is God saying? Never mind. What is God saying, right? What is God saying? Moshe, if you think about it, according to the Bible, reached the spiritual level that no other human being has ever reached. Pe'el pe'a dabrebo, which is, by the way, just before this story in the verses there. God says, I speak to him face to face. Abraham, so he was in a dream when I spoke to him. Moshe has this intensity, this direct relationship with God that no other human being has ever achieved. He's up on Sinai, which is the pinnacle of his personal spiritual career. He's on the 40th day of Sinai, of the receiving of the Torah. So this is Moshe's big day. This is the apex of spirituality. What about the Jewish people? Jewish people just got out of Egypt. They just, 40 days ago, got the Ten Commandments from God. And they're at their nadir. They're as low as the people have ever sunk, according to tradition. The sin of the golden calf. The sin of the golden calf is not just, you know, they got a golden calf and everybody went around and said, ooh, anus dominus sanctum. No. I mean, if you read the verses, forget about the Kabbalah, the mystical approach and what. I mean, the verses seem to imply there was some massive orgy. They're having this huge, massive orgy at the foot of Sinai. That's not just the guy who gets up and walks out of synagogue. That's not even the guy who gets up and walks out of synagogue in the middle of the sermon, or the guy who gets up and walks out of synagogue in the middle of the sermon on Yom Kippur. That's the guy who gets up and walks up to the ark on Yom Kippur in the middle of the sermon and urinates. I mean, that's what the Chet HaEgel was. Says the Meshech Chachmah of Meir Simcha of Dvinsk, he says, if they're all the way down there, you can't be all the way up here. Very powerful idea today. You can't sit in your yeshiva and achieve this incredible spirituality if the people are out in the gutter. It just doesn't work that way. Something's wrong. We have to find somewhere in the middle. God. He argues with God. And Moshe offers three arguments to God, because God says, Heref mimeni va'ashmidem. Leave me be, I'm going to destroy them. So the Talmud says, Moshe understands, what does it mean, leave me be, I'm going to destroy them? If Moshe doesn't do something, the Jewish people, that's it. Finished. Ein hadavar taluy elabi, it depends only on me. Tremendous idea. The lesson we learn from Moshe at that particular moment is that that's how a human being is supposed to feel. And so Moshe argues with God. And this is incredible. A human being is arguing with God. God says, listen, consequence. We spoke about punishment being not punishment, but consequence in Judaism. So, Jewish people, they're down a path. They take a whamma of a detour. I mean, it doesn't get more of a detour than that. They're on their way to California from New York, and somehow they find themselves in, I don't know, Toronto, right? Something's wrong. And Moshe understands that he has to argue with God. So God says the consequence is we have to destroy them. That's the consequence. Makes sense. If you're sick, you have to have penicillin. You can't argue, no, we don't want to have the penicillin. But that's what Moshe does. Very difficult. And Moshe offers three arguments. He says, first of all, right? Lama, why did you take these Jewish people out? L'chalot utam be'arim. Where did you take them? You took them. I love this argument. Moshe says, listen, you took them out of Egypt. 10 plagues. You split the sea. Sinai. Such a waste. What a waste. I mean, you know, all that energy. What, are you going to destroy him now? And then he says, Lama yomru mitzrayim leimor b'ra'u tziyam l'chalot tambarim. And what do I love? This is like the Jewish mother's response. What are the goyim going to say? What are the Egyptians going to say? They had the Jews for 210 years. It took 210 years for the Jews to rebel against them. You had them for what? 7 weeks? It's going to look awful. Listen, you're going to make a bad name for yourself. Don't do it. And then he says, oh yeah, by the way, Zechor Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov Shenishbat L'Emsham. Remember, you promised Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. It's a very strange order. But okay. But that's not the most incredible thing about this whole story. Because then comes a word that will change the course of destiny, of Jewish history. Vayinachem Hashem. And God vayinachems. God nachems. So I want to ask you, what do you think nachems means? Vayi nachem, and he nachemed, he chemed. What do you think that means? What does God do? Well, let me give you a clue. God says, listen, Mo, I'm going to destroy the Jewish people. That's what he says. Now, does God destroy the Jewish people? Hello? No, I don't think so. So what does God do? He changes his mind. Now, this may present somewhat of a philosophical problem here. What does that mean, God changes his mind? How can God change his mind? I mean, if I change my mind... Yeah, I remember there was this show called Happy Days when I was a kid. You ever see this, Happy Days, right? We grew up, right? Bunch of little juvenile delinquents wearing leather jackets and a comb walking around saying, hey, right? Because that was the Fonz, right? Now, the Fonz, he was perfection, right? How they convinced an entire generation that the Fonz was perfection is beyond me. But they got away with it. I guess TV is getting more sophisticated, right? So he could never be wrong, because he was the Fonz, right? So one time he makes this big boo-boo, this big mistake, and he's wrong. And Richie, Mr. Cunningham, there's Mr. Brilliant, debonair, debutante, right? So Richie Cunningham, right? Real bold individual. He's going to teach the Fonz that the Fonz is wrong. the Fonz has to apologize. So the Fonz goes with Richie into his office, which of course makes it more amazing that we thought that this guy was our hero. His office was a men's room, but okay, right? So they're in their office. They're in their office, right? They're in their office. Don't ask me. They're in their office. And he's trying to tell Richie, I was woo woo woo. Right? I was woo 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 woo. And Richie says, you were wrong. That's it. So that's like God. Like God comes to Moshe and says, I'm going to destroy the Jewish people. Moshe says, oh yeah? Well, what about this? 1, 2, 3. God says, oh yeah, I was woo woo woo. I was woo woo woo. How could God be woo woo woo? It doesn't make sense. I mean, God says to Moshe, listen, we're going to go with plan A. So Moshe says, well, no, that doesn't make sense. He says, okay, you know what? You're right. I'm wrong. We'll go with plan B. Now that can't be what's going on there, right? Because that's absurd. So how do I understand that? How could God change his mind? And I want you to understand something. This whole section, this story, you know when we read this story? I know. We read this story 4 times, in addition to when it falls in the portion of the week. And every fast day except for Yom Kippur, on the 9th of Av in the afternoon, on the fast of Esther, on the 17th of Tammuz, we read this portion. You know why? Because this is the fundamental question of prayer. How can God change his mind? How can I walk into a synagogue, open up a prayer book, and ask God to change his mind? It doesn't make sense. And that's exactly what Moshe asks God to do. But God does it. So what's going on? So sometimes people will say, well, God wanted to see what Moshe would do. Right? And God wanted to see, would Moshe respond? Would Moshe? But that's, of course, equally absurd, I mean, I think. Because that means that my vision of God, if God is just saying, I'm going to destroy the Jewish people, so Moshe will pray and argue and whatever, so then your vision of God is, I don't know, Moses, going to destroy the Jewish people. What you going to do about it? Like, that's not my image of God either. One more question, which I think perhaps will clue us in. This is actually something we once mentioned in the context of a class, maybe last month, the month before. So, and that is a very interesting detail. Do you know what it is traditionally that you say when you walk into a synagogue? You may know, if I walk into synagogue in the morning, there's a traditional prayer at the beginning of the prayer book. And I urge you to look this. It's a beautiful, beautiful prayer. Do you know what it is? Anybody know? Excellent. The Ma Tovu. You ever hear that song? Ma Tovu, O Halecha Yaakov, right? He just broke the eardrums of anybody listening to this tape ever in history. But Ma Tovu, how goodly are thy tents, O Jacob. It's rather a strange thing to begin my prayer with. Like, I'm walking into synagogue, I would think, begin with the Shema. Begin with, you know, blessed art thou, O Lord our God, who gives us, you know, Marabu Masech Hashem, how wondrous, how magnanimous and magnificent, and are all your actions, God. I mean, what is Matovu? How goodly are thy tents? So it's very interesting. The difficulty here is paramount because of who said Matovu. Does anybody here know who said the Matovu? This will really blow your mind. Ma Tovu was said by one of the 10 top bad guys in Jewish history. There was a prophet by the name of Balaam. And this guy was charged, this is in the book of Numbers, in the portion known as Balak. He was charged by the king of Moab, a guy by the name of Balak, to curse the Jewish people. He was a prophet, a non-Jewish prophet. And somehow Moab reached the conclusion that they weren't going to be able to destroy the Jews on the battlefield. They kind of had this great general way up there, the big, magnificent eye that wouldn't let them get away with it. But they thought maybe they could mess it up for them spiritually. And so they try all these different games. You know, they send Midianite girls to seduce them. You know, come and be with me, honey, just bow down to the idol, that sort of thing. And all these different games. And one of them is Balaam goes up there to curse the Jewish people. Somehow, this is a much wider discussion, if Balaam succeeds in cursing the Jewish people, that's it. Jewish people are finished. They're cursed by a prophet, that's it. So it doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? I mean, Balaam certainly has every intention of cursing them. And the motivation is certainly there. And he's being offered a fortune. He's going to be a mega millionaire by Balak. But he gets up there and he sees something and he says, wow, look how wondrous these people are. And before he knows it, he's blessing them. So what does he see? So Rashi, that super commentary on the Bible, says that he sees a very strange thing. He sees that no one tent opening faces another tent opening. That's what he sees. He goes up on the mountain to curse them. He sees that no one tent opening faces another tent opening. I mean, it's nice. I guess it speaks about the fact that, you know, they had a little bit of respect for each other, you know, close your blinds, don't look into other people's windows. I mean, that's nice. But this is how I start my prayer. Unless, of course, you stop to think again. How many Jews were in the desert? How many Jews were in the desert? Anybody know? 600,000 men between the ages of 20 and 60. The only number we have is for the army. That's got to be at least 3 million people. Men, women, children, above 60, below 20. That's a lot of tents. Now, forget for the moment what Balaam was doing up on the mountain, checking out all of those tent openings. You know what I mean? Like, uh-huh, yeah, no tent openings there. Uh-huh. I mean, you can do that all day. But that becomes a very significant thing, that no tent opening happened to face another tent opening. Great miracle. Unless, of course, you stop to think again. What's the best way to make sure that no one tent opening faces another tent opening? That's what we do in the army. Have them all facing the same way. What's the big deal? I'll tell you what the big deal is. It means that they had a system. They had a system to ensure that no one tent opening faced another. Now, I don't know what their system was. Maybe when they camped, there was a flag up at one corner of the camp. And everybody faced that flag. Maybe they had, you ever seen Monty Python? Maybe people went through the camp with coconuts. Tents to the east! Tents to the east! I don't know. Whatever it was. But they had a system to ensure that no one human being took for granted the respect of another human being. And that's how I begin my prayer service. I don't begin thinking about God. I begin with this weird burlap sale story because it represents somehow that I should be thinking about how to find ways to respect my fellow human being. And by the way, if you look at the beginning of the prayer, there's no mention of God. Elu mitzvot she'Hashem kem lo lama ba. These are the commandments that have reward in the world to come. Respect kibur aveim, respect your parents. Gmilut chasadim, loving kindness. And there are allusions to loving kindness all through the beginning of the prayers. Until much later when I get to my real relationship with God. The whole beginning, the blessings, as a matter of fact, the Lubavitch, who patterned their Siddur after the Ari HaKadosh, was the greatest mystic in the last 500 years. And he did many, many things. He died very young. One of the things he did was he had a profound influence on the prayer book. And in his prayer book, which Lubavitch adopted, you can look up a Lubavitch prayer book, the thing that he begins when you enter into the Beit Knesset, into the synagogue, because this is not when you wake up, this is when you go into synagogue, where other people are, into the community. He says, Hareini mekabel atmi, I accept upon myself the mitzvah, shel v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. That's what he says you should say when you walk into synagogue. Because that's what praying with other people is. Learning how to get along, learning how to love, how to respect other human beings. So what is all this? So I want to tell you something. You know what prayer is? Prayer is a system. And it's a system that's designed to make me a better person. And if I pray in the fashion that allows me to become that better person, then I become a different person. I've changed. If you can go a single day without appreciating that there are other people who are sick and something's wrong with them, I had a friend, still lives in the Alunchwood area. Name is Kobe. He was in a tank. I wasn't with him. They were in a different unit. He was in going through, I think, Rashidiyah towards Tzur and Sidon on the coastal road up towards Beirut. And his tank was hit by a Sagar anti-tank missile. This is a nasty toy, the Russian anti-tank missile. What it does is it first hits the tank wall and makes an implosion and breaks through the tank. And then it shoots a stream of lead at about 4,000 degrees centigrade into the tank. So everything that comes near it is completely burned. Now, Kobe was a gunner. You can spot a Sagar if you know what you're doing and you can get your tank crew out or you can fight against it. Whatever the case was, the last person out of a tank is the gunner because he's deep in the belly and he's got to wait for the commander to get out. So he was burned almost 80% of his body, third-degree burn. Third-degree burn, you know what a third-degree burn is? A first-degree burn is a very severe burn. That's the kind of thing you would go to the emergency room. A second-degree burn is so severe that it creates shalpuchiyot, boils and blisters and infections. A third degree boner is where the skin is completely charred. It's completely charred. Now, on the one hand, it's a much better type of injury because it burns the nerve endings. So you don't feel, initially, almost any pain. That's what they say. So that if you're in a battlefield, until they get you to the hospital, you don't feel pain. But the rehabilitation process is probably the most difficult that there is. He was in the hospital. He went through something like 600 different plastic surgery, skin grafting operations. He was there for almost a year. Very painful process. So a few of us went to visit him up in Rambam Hospital in Haifa, which is the burn center. And you're not allowed to go in there unless you're, I think it was over 16, because it's not an easy place to visit. They don't put bandages on these types of burns because, I don't know, somehow it retards the healing process and it can cause tremendous pain to pull them off. So you walk into this place. Now, we didn't know exactly where he was. And we asked, and they told us, you know, go in the elevator, go up to the second floor. We get out, and the stench hits you. It's like formaldehyde and burnt flesh. Very difficult. And there were a lot of, unfortunately, burn patients in the middle of a war. So we went over to somebody who was obviously there, a burn patient. Somebody else said, do you know Kobe such and such? And the guy's looking at us. And I notice in his eye, this patient, that there's like this little moisture in the corner. And it takes him like a minute, and he says, is that me? It's me. He was so burned. You didn't even recognize it. I mean, could you imagine? You walk out of an elevator. You want to make somebody feel better. You want to say, I want you to heal. And you say, you're so burned, I can't recognize you. You know what to say. I'm sure my heart fell into my stomach. What do you say? If you can go a day without appreciating how lucky you are to be healthy, something's wrong with you. But if you can go a day without stopping to take the time to think that there are other human beings who are unhealthy, then something's wrong with you. Comes along the system of prayer and says, I want you to think about that. I want you to verbalize it. And I want you to verbalize it three times a day. You're a soldier. You're in war. You should specifically be thinking about peace. And don't ever forget about peace. You know how many times a day we mention peace? We mention it in the Kaddish. We mention it in the grace. All day I should be thinking about peace. Because if you take a day and you don't stop to appreciate how lucky you are to have peace, and look, with all our problems relative to the generations of our grandparents, we have peace. Do we appreciate that? And do we appreciate that there are other people who are living in war? That children in Yugoslavia are in pain? Do we appreciate that? Comes along the Torah and says, Chazal tradition, the prayer system, this is designed to make you a better person. And if you pray, then you become better. You become changed. Moshe doesn't change God's mind. God can't change his mind. He doesn't change. Moshe changes. Moshe before prayer is not the same as Moshe after prayer. He's a different person. He's gone through the most advanced sensitivity training system seminar you've ever heard of. Now, let's assume for the moment that we're not Moshe. So what Moshe can do in a few sentences might take me a lifetime. But the model is set. And that's exactly what's going on in Matovu. And that's exactly what the issue of prayer is. I say Rafa'inu because that makes me a better human being. It makes me more sensitive. And that's why prayer is one of the three main points on which the world stands. It fits exactly with what Torah is, and it fits exactly with Gemilut Chasadim is. Torah, if you think about it, is a gift that comes from God. It's not something we can change. It's something effectively that changes us. Gemilut Chasadim, loving kindness, acts. That's how we change the world. Prayer is the conduit between those two. It's my ability to redirect that energy towards God. But how do I do that? And this is not all there is to prayer. How do I do that? I do that by developing a different level of sensitivity. I do that by expressing what I have to make myself aware of. And that's, by the way, why we have all these specific prayers. I mean, this is just the edge of the iceberg. Because coming up with a system like this is not an easy thing. These words were written by the men of the great assembly, men who walked with prophets. And perhaps their ability to express these ideas, especially in the Hebrew language, was on a level perhaps far beyond ours. And if that's so, could it be that there's a value to delving into their specific usage and language? That's the challenge of prayer. It's an experiment. And you don't get it in a day. It's a lot of work. And you shouldn't try it all at once, because that could be too much. But if you want to really develop a relationship with prayer, and through that a relationship with God, via a relationship with your fellow human being, take a challenge. Take a piece of prayer. See what it does. But it can't just be rote. It has to be something from inside. And I know when I was developing a relationship with prayer, that's what I did. I took the prayers one at a time. Sometimes it took me weeks to work on one. So think about it. The practice of regularly considering some of the issues that the prayer book raises is a magnificent practice, and it will elevate you.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.